Okay, good morning, everybody. Welcome back. It is wonderful to be learning together. We're in our second stage of our journey called Who's Asking the Question. We're learning a little bit about the Mefarshim, and today's topic is understanding Rashi, trying to unpack one of the most complicated and vast commentaries on all of Torah and all of history. We wanted to take a moment to thank Elliot and Shandy Horowitz, who are sponsoring today's shiur in honor of the introduction of two new Horowitz grandchildren. With the wishings of Mazal Tov, first to Nili Sarina, who was named yesterday in Israel, Nili being, of course, Nesach Yisrael Lo Yishaker, the eternity of Israel, and their grandson, Erez Yona, who was just named a week ago as well. Erez is named after Sugihara. Sugihara was a person who saved, one of the Hasidic Umos HaOlam, who saved thousands of Jewish lives, including Shandy Horowitz's father, who came through, went east to be saved, and so the name Sugihara actually comes from the word cedar. Erez is cedar, so it is a special connection. Also, that Sugihara's passing is commemorated this Tuesday, the 24th of Tammuz, and so as the history of the families in posterity and the future of Ezra Hashem should always continue that way as well. Mazal Tov, we are looking forward to many great things from the continued Horowitz family. Mazal Tov. Let us learn. Rashi, it seems like everybody knows Rashi, right? Everybody thinks they know Rashi because we've spent so much time in all of our education learning Rashi. Who has not learned a Rashi? The idea to understand what Rashi is doing on Chumash is so complex. It's such a vast topic. Let's just take a little background, a little bit of bio. Thank you so much, Jack. A little bit of background into what we're trying to who Rashi was and what he was about. Rashi lived between the years 1040 and 1155, and he was born in Troy in northern France, and he died in Troy in northern France. Now, when he was a young man, he went off to study in the great yeshiva of Rabbeinu Gershom Or HaGolah, who was in Mainz, in the Germanic states. That was where Torah was generally found. And it's interesting to note that part of that development, just to understand why Jews were in Europe in the first place, is the first place in Europe that Jews came to, of course, was Rome. Right? Because after the Roman exile, that's when the vast amounts of Jews were taken into servitude, captivity, or just for commercial reasons moved to Rome and Italy. And we have invitations from the Germanic states of Jews to be invited up northwards. And there were five generations of Jews that we can trace moving northwards, moving up into the Germanic states. And as they move upwards, north from Italy into Germany, Germany does not become Germany until the 19th century, right? But the various different Germanic states. And slowly they move from the German areas based on imitation, based on commerce, based on economic reasons and tolerance for a few years. They move into the areas of France as well. So now this is really the fifth generation of Jews who are moving into Europe. Rashi's settling down, it's good economic conditions. Jews are interacting with the Christians around them. They're tolerated at least at the beginning, before the Crusades start. And this is where Rashi seems to be found. He moves back to the Germany area to Mainz for his studying in Yeshiva. Rabbeinu Gershom has already passed away, but he studies under one of the Talmidim of Rabbeinu Gershom called Rabbeinu Yaakov Ibn Yakar. Rashi quotes him a number of times throughout his Pirushim. Rashi learns Tanakh and Gemara. It was Rabbeinu Gershom's curriculum was to learn all of Tanakh before they got to Gemara, something which we are ill and lacking in today. And he was able then to move back from, he went to Yeshiva in Worms and returned at the age of 30 to Troy, where he took on a rabbinic leadership role, opened his own yeshiva there, and between being involved in community leadership and teaching, was also had a business as a winemaker in Troy. There's debate on this academically as to what his true profession was. Some of the stories they tell about Rashi is that he would sit in the lecture about very complex Gemaras. Rabbeinu Gershom was very involved in trying to conglomerate, trying to pull together all the manuscripts of the Gemara. Remember, there's no printing at this point in time. There are various different texts of the Gemara. Rabbeinu Gershom Yeshiva was very involved in trying to consolidate those texts of the Gemara. It was very hard to read because when they didn't know what to when they didn't understand the Gemara, there was nowhere to turn. Right? They weren't looking at Rashi because he was in the room, right? And there was no article. There was nothing. There was nothing on the side. Right? It was just the manuscript of the Gemara. And the legend has it that when the teacher would come across a difficult passage in the Talmud, Rashi would sit in the room and write an explanation that he felt was appropriate for, and after the lecture would slip it into the manuscript of the lecturer giver, and people would find these mysterious slips of parchment, of paper, that contained these explanations, and they were so clear, they were so illuminating, they were so simple, that people would start copying these manuscripts, these mysterious keys into understanding the complexities of the Talmud. And one time he was caught putting it in, and sort of his cover was blown, and he became known as Rashi. Rashi had three daughters. They say perhaps he had a fourth one who passed away young, but we know that he had three daughters, each of them married very fine, upstanding Talmidei Chachamim, who continued much of the work of Rashi afterwards. Rashi wrote a pirush on all of Tanakh. Arguably in Ezra, there's a question as to whether that is Rashi or not. Some people just call it the Mefaresh, they explain it because it may not be Rashi, maybe in the vein of his work. And he does explain all of the Gemaras. They say, you know, when they always say, where did Rashi die? So when people say in Troy in France, but where did Rashi really die?
In the
Valley of Basra, Psachim, and Makos.
Last week.
Okay, good. Yeah, Rashi. Yeah. So Rashi, so meaning say, so you know where Rashi dies, because in three Masechtos, we was mid-writing, that's where we know, and Hutek takes over. So in Makos, it's the Rav Vani's son-in-law. In Basra, it's his grandson, the Rashbam. So you sort of like, and in the Psachim, it's also the Rashbam. So we know where Rashi dies because there were three Masechtos they were still in the middle of. And if for those of us who are studying Baba Basra, it's a much longer Masechta because of that. Because his grandson spent a lot more time explaining, which itself is actually indicative of Rashi's brilliance, right? Which means to say is Rashi was able to take a lot of complex information and be able to make it understandable in a very short amount of time. As you continue in time, you'll notice that people spend more time writing. Rashi spent less time writing and more time being able to explain it, which means that every word of Rashi is incredibly significant. It's hard to overstate the impact of Rashi in our lives, both on the Talmud and on the Gemara. By the way, he also wrote Tshuvos. So we have the response of Rashi. There's a Siddur, which is based on his notes, the Siddur of Rashi as well. But what is fascinating is that the first printed book, Jewish book ever, the first printed Hebrew book ever, was printed in 1469, the Bomberg edition of the Chumash with Rashi. So the first printed edition. Rashi has the most amount of super commentaries than any other explanation of the Torah. I mean, that means a super commentary is somebody who's explaining the commentary, right? So there are more people writing about Rashi than any other Mefarish in Jewish history as well. Really, just remarkable of how much he has influenced us. There's not a school child who comes back from school who does not know Rashi and appreciate Rashi. So now, let's try to understand what Rashi is doing. Because Rashi does not write an introduction to his Pirush. Unlike, let's say later on, the Ramban and the Ibn Ezra and even the Rashbam, nobody who explained what they're doing and why they're doing it, Rashi doesn't. He just gets going, right? He just starts the Torah. In fact, he starts the Torah quoting Rabbi Yitzchak. That's the first Rashi on the Torah. And there's a debate. The Taz says that, in fact, that refers to his father, Rav Shlomo ben Yitzchak, Rav Shlomo Yitzchaki. There's a debate as to that, because that Rabbi Yitzchak is found in the Tanchuma as well. Was that a later misinterpretation of what Rashi was saying? There's a whole debate academically as to who he's quoting, but nonetheless, Rashi just starts his Pirush, and that's it. He keeps going. Rashi does quote his father in Gemara and Avodah Zarah once. There's a place where he specifically quotes his father and prefers his perspective over his Rebbe's perspective when rendering the understanding of Gemara. The Birzimei just jumps straight in. But there are times where Rashi lets us in behind the curtain and tells us a little bit of what he's doing, And I had the opportunity of studying this a little bit when I took my intro to Bible at YU and when I studied with Rabbi Chaim Angel. And I think it's important to understand a little more academically speaking what Rashi is actually trying to do, rather than we have it from our grade teachers and we just hear Rashi all the time. But to understand what Rashi is actually trying to do is really important. So let's start at the beginning. We're told what I put in as the first source. This is actually the beginning of in source 2 and 3. Rashi is commenting on HaKadosh Baruch Hu in Gan Eden, and it says that Adam and Eve, Adam and Chava hear the voice of Hashem moving throughout the garden. In source 3, Rashi says, Yesh midrashei Haggadah rabim. There are many midrashim on this. Now, just to clarify, a midrash is a traditional statement of one of the sages from the times of the Gemara, or the Mishnah, or later on the Gemara, mostly the Mishnah. And there are two types of midrash. A midrash could be a midrash halacha. There are examples being Mechilta, Sifri, and Sifra. Those are midrashim halacha, Toras Kohanim. Those are midrashim which are deriving halacha. And then there's midrash agada, which he's referring to here, which is homiletical. And that's that in a certain sense, besides the Targum, which we spent time learning about last week, that's all that's on the table. Meaning on the bookshelf, you have Tanakh and you have Midrashim, right? So the Midrashim are the either halachic or agadic understandings of the text, and that's all we have. So Rashi says, there are many Midrashi agada, many homiletical understandings of this pasuk, Ukvar Sidrum Rabbi Hussein al-Mechonam, Bebereshis Rabba Uvashar Midrashas, and they are to be found in the Midrash Rabba and other Midrashim. Vani lo basi, but I have not come, Ela only Lipshutai Shel Mikra, for the pshat, v'la agada hamiyusheves direi hamikra, davar davur al ofanav, a matter which is spoken al ofanav. We'll translate it in a second. So Rashi actually says three things here. Let's just break them down to pieces. The first thing he says is, I am coming to understand the pshat. And this is the we'll call the beginning of the era of the pashtanim, of those who seek the pshat. What does pshat mean precisely? And this itself is a debate. The most classic understanding of what pshat means is something which fits the grammar, the language, and the context best, right? That's the general understanding. You can go a little further than this. Elliot, do you want to take a stab at this? How did Dr. Leibowitz understand it?
Plain sense, common sense.
Common sense, right? So our common sense understanding of the text as opposed to the homiletical philosophical perspective of the meaning of it. What is it actually meaning, like the we'll call it the lessons, rather. What does it actually, in common sense, mean? My teacher, Rabbi Chaim Angel, would explain it as the following. And this is, I think, a really, really powerful perspective. You may debate this, but it is a very powerful perspective. And that is, he quotes the Sridei Eish of Yechiel Yaakov Weinberg, who was a great Talmud Chacham who survived the Holocaust. That's why he calls his Pirush Sridei Eish. Sridei Me'esh is the ember that came out of the fire. He moved to Switzerland and he wrote many, many tshuvas. Very, very respected teacher in Israel. And he is commenting on the Rambam, and he comes to a point where he disagrees with Rav Chaim Soloveitchik's perspective on the Rambam. Rav Chaim Soloveitchik is about the Efer Parah. And and he's discussing over here a particular halachic aspect over here about the Rebbe Chaim. And if you look in the source, in source 4 on the top of the page over here, he says the following. It is, it's the end of the second line. He says, V'af shehi charifus gedola v'ru'uya le'ga'on shekamoisai. Even though Rebbe Chaim's explanation of the Rambam is brilliant and is worthy of a sage of his likes, Mikomokom Pashtus Loshon HaRambam Ein Okein. That's not what the Rambam means in Shat. It says, Kamavuar La Ma'ayin Oyev Emes Lamitai. As a person who is seeking truth will find, Ukvar Martin, I already said, Shechidusha Rabbeinu Hagon Rochayim, Heim Amitziyim Mibichinas Ha'iyun Va'amuk. What he's saying is true on the level of Iyun, on trying to get to the depth of the idea. Aval Loi Tomid B'muvan History, but not necessarily historically speaking, what I mean to say, in what the Rambam actually was meaning when he wrote it. Shederech limudoi hoiso acheres mizu shel agon rochaim. This does not diminish Rav Chaim's work. Meaning, that's the greatest compliment you can give anybody. Is Rav Chaim was so brilliant, he could even be called a new Rambam, right? But that wasn't what the Rambam was saying. I mean, that wasn't what the Rambam intended, okay, in certain circumstances. Right, so now that's a controversial statement, right? Because those who go with a brisker derech will say, no, that's exactly, the Rambam intended a chakira, which has two ways of looking at it, which explains the stira in the Rambam. Says, sometimes yes, but sometimes no. Therefore, what is his now? What's relevant for us is not the dust storm that this kicks up about the brisker derech of learning Rambam, and but what does pshat mean according to the Sridayesh? Pshat according to the Sridayesh means original intent of author. Original intent of author. Now, so transposing that on over here is if we put this now to the Torah, original intent. Okay, meaning you say what was the basic idea that's been conveyed by the author in this particular case? That is not to the exclusion of the Iyun Ha'amuk in this case, right? Because HaKadosh Baruch Hu is kapatish yifot tzetzela, as the Gemara tells us. It's like an anvil which hits upon a rock and the sparks go out in every direction. All those sparks are coming from that rock. So here he's not, decrying or limiting all those other aspects of Pshat Remez Rush and Sod, but the Pshat itself is, so to speak, what the average person is going to be understanding was the intent of what the Torah was saying in this case. Okay, so that is another way of describing Pshat. That's more encompassing than the original description of Pshat. So that's the first thing. Here's an example where Rashi does this himself. So let's look at an example where Rashi actually does this. Here we go. Beginning of Parshas Va'era. It describes our HaKadosh Baruch Hu comes to Moshe and he says, Va'era, HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, I appeared to, remember, if you remember the context, Moshe Rabbeinu has been sent to Pharaoh, and he comes to Pharaoh and tells us, let's let this people go. Pharaoh now removes the straw. They have to make bricks. They don't have the necessary ingredients. Their people, the taskmasters are getting beaten. And Moshe Rabbeinu is getting complained to. He comes to Hashem and he says, you've made it worse since I came. And then HaKadosh Baruch Hu gives him the speech. And the speech is the beginning of Va'era. And I appear to Avraham, Yitzhak, and Yaakov in my name, Kel Shakai. And then he goes on to describe this point, and Moshe Rabbeinu goes back, and they don't listen to Israel. So Rashi says in this, in Source 5, Rabbeinu Dor Shul Inyan Shalmala, Shomar Lam Moshe Lama Hariyoi. So Moshe asked, why did you do bad? Omer HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Chaval Da'avdin V'loi Mishtakchen. Woe on those who are no longer here. He says, "Yeah, Shlili Sonen Al Misa Sa'ava." It's hard to pay him. Niglesi Lohem Bekel Shakay Velo Amru Mashemecha. Va'ato Amarta Mashemoy Amar Lomay Amar Lohem. So Avram, Yitzhak, and Yaakov. What's the comparison to Moshe Rabbeinu? I appear to them only in one aspect of my revelation in this world, which is Kel Shakai. You ask me, "What's your name?" HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, "I am Ekhya Asher Ekhya. I will be what I will be, whatever that means. That name of Hashem." Meaning, you demanded more revelation of me, and yet. In the next Rashi, Kishibikish Avram Nikbar Esara, Volemot Sakever Al Shek Adjakar Bedomim Ram Merubim, and Avram, who is promised the land and has to buy it with an exorbitant price from the Bnei Ches, V'chemi Yitzhak Iruru Alav Ala Be'eros Asher Chafar, and Yitzhak had the wells that were taken away, V'chem Yaakov Ayikin Eschelkas Asarin, Yaakov to buy the field as well, in Tosar Alav, just to plant his tent, V'lohiru Achamidosai, and they didn't ask about my Midos, meaning they had a lesser name of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and they didn't ask, and you have a greater name, and you do ask. That's what the Midrash is saying. That's what Rashi says. Now, says Rashi, that's all a midrash, right? Rashi says, "V'ein a midrash misyashev achar mikra mibnei kamet advarim." Rashi says this explanation does not fit neatly into what the psukim are saying. Why? Achas shelo nemar ushmi Hashem lo shaluli. It doesn't say they didn't ask my name. No dati, I told them, right? Right, so the way this midrash is framing it is, they asked this, and I gave them this, and you asked this, and I gave... No, it doesn't fit that part. V'im tamar, lo yidi yom shekach shemoy, haray tchila kishenigla al Avram ben Abasorim, ne'mar ani Hashem, asher atzisincha meru kastim. Look at the psukim, it says, ani Hashem, I am a God, yod kei vav kei. Right, Hashem has already talked to Avram Avinu in that name. That's number one. And similarly, it doesn't fit the context of the continuation of Hashem's speech over here. And therefore, Rashi says, skipping the bottom parts, that's the same language we just looked at. And you can find the Joshua elsewhere. And he goes on to say, in source 6, what does it mean? It means I never really explained myself fully. I never explained the end of the story, and they only saw the middle of the story, and they didn't complain. Not about names and what name means what, because that doesn't seem to click in the same way easily, right? So Rashi is now taking, liberty to say, here is the Midrash, but I don't think that this is what it is expressing in this time for a number of reasons, contextually, and because if you go back, the name of Hashem appears in this, and also the way the text itself does not seem to warrant this. So Rashi therefore moves away from the Midrashic angle and gives what he calls pshat, what he thinks is this. This is an example of what's called pshuta shel mikra, Rashi moving away. This, what Rashi is doing over here, is going to be expanded upon hugely once we get to Ibn Ezra and Rashbam, right? They're going to do this almost verbatim. Rashi doesn't do this so often, but this is an example of what's pshuta shel mikra. Next thing he says is agada hamiyusheves divrei hamikra. You see, that was the second thing that he said, is an agada, which is miyusheves, Mikra. So what does that refer to? So again, on Rashi's Hameyasheves Dira Mikra. So Rashi has on his shelf multiple midrashim. And the way that Dr. Avigal Rak explains it in her book on this, which it was really excellent, is if you think about it from the following perspective, Rashi has all these midrashim. So how do you figure out which midrash to quote? Meaning, Rashi is primarily midrash. Most of what Rashi does is a Gemara and Midrash. If you look actually in the art scroll, they put you where it's coming from. Most of it is not the pshat that we just saw where Rashi diverges. Almost everything Rashi says is from the Direi Chazal. But then the question is, so what does he choose? So the answer is he chooses parts of Midrash which are miyasheves, the Mikra. Meaning the ones that he feels are most aligned to understanding what the simple part reading of the text is. So, let's take an example. So it says the pasuk tells us after Kriyas Yamsuf in Bishalach, Vayasa Moshe es Bnei Yisrael es Yisrael miYamsuf. Moshe Rabbeinu comes and they travel away from Yamsuf. So there's two midrashim as an example. The Mechilta of Rabbi Shmuel says in source 8. Rabbi Eliezer, source 9. I'm sorry, I'm working on different numbers here. So the Mechilta says Rabbi Eliezer Omer Al Pi Hagvura Naso. They travel by Best Hashem's command. Then it describes what's the pasuk mean by Yasa Moshe. They did not say, wait a second, where's food? Where's the next rest stop going to be? They just went, and this is the praise of Israel. That's what the Midrash Rabbi Chilta says. So this pasuk is describing the greatness of Israel. However, the early Tanchuma says, not so, it disagrees. It says, Ma'u v'yasa Moshe in source 10, Shisiyon bal korchon, shilo b'tov asan. They weren't interested. They were collecting the gold at the side of the sea, right? And Moshe Rabbeinu had to pull them away. So two contradicting midrashim. Which of those two midrashim does Rashi quote? Just from memory, quickly. Second. Rashi quotes the second one. He quotes the Tanchuma, right? So you say, why did Rashi? Rashi had two midrashim in front of him. He clearly read both of these. These are early midrashim. And he quotes the Tanchuma over quoting the Mechilta. Why did he say that the movement of Israel away from Yamsuf was against their will rather than Hagid Shavachon? The answer is because look at the word. The word says, does not say Vayisa. They traveled. It says Vayasa. Vayasa is he forced them to travel. Which means to say, Rashi says, when I'm going to tell you a midrash, when I'm going to interpret the text, it's going to be Agada Hamiyasheves Es Hamikra. I'm going to choose a midrash which is in line with what the language is telling us. This is an example of what Rashi is doing. There's going to be many times that Rashi will therefore choose off the shelf one midrash over another midrash based on what? Based on what he believes is going to be the Pshuta Shel Mikra of that midrash. That's that's the second part. So number one is Pshat, where Rashi will diverge from midrash because he feels the midrash is not relating to the actual text itself, We saw an example of that. Another one is where you'll choose one medrash over another medrash because of the way it will fit the text. And number three is, he says, Davar Davur Al Ofanov. What does that mean? So here's something I learned from Rabbi J.J. Schacht, and I think it's such a profound point. That phrase of Rashi is actually a pasuk. That's a pasuk in Mishlei. So you want to know what it means? Look at the pasuk. So it's a pasuk in Mishlei. The pasuk says, Tapuchei Zahav, in source 12, b'maskios kesev, golden apples and silver show pieces, Davar Davur Al Ofanov. What does that mean? So how do you know what a pasuk means in Tanakh? What do? You look at Rashi. You want to know what Rashi meant when he quotes this pasuk? Look what Rashi says on that pasuk, right? Very good. So Rashi defines the terms. He says over there in Mishlei, because Rashi wrote on all of Tanakh, he says, Al Kanoi, on its stand, or Kanoi comes from Kain, which means truth, on its stand, where it's balanced. V'dugmasoi, Nasasi emecho afuno, mevuseses umiyusheves bikirbi. It is balanced. Common sense, perhaps, is the word, as Elliot, as you were saying from Dr. Leibowitz, is something which just it's at equilibrium. The fulcrums are just the right balance. It sits. Rashi, in fact, quotes a pasuk over there. Nasasi emecho afuno. What is the word? He's explaining the word. Which word in the pasuk in Mishlei is he explaining? Ofanov. What does ofan mean? Usually, people translate it as a wheel. Ofan, right? Vayaser is ofan merkavosov, right? The wheel sort of. But Rashi is not saying that here. Rashi quotes a pasuk in Tehillim. You want to know what that means? Go to Tehillim. Who explains to Tehillim? Rashi, good. So let's go to Tehillim. He says, Ani ani in Tehillim peiches, v'goveh minar, nosasi emecho afuna. That's the pasuk he's quoting in the Rashi in Mishlei. It's the full circle. Right as Rashi says, afuna miusheves umavuseses emoscha belibi. It's grounded. There's a gravity. It balances. So you want to understand what Rashi is trying to do? Davar davur al ofanov. Something which is balanced. Something which rests well. So Rashi is explaining himself based on Psukim Tanakh, which he elsewhere explains what that means. Here we have the gravity of what something, how it rests. So you want to understand what Rashi is doing? His idea is he's trying to get to, we'll call it, something which fits in the text. And therefore, when choosing Agada or when diverging from Agada, he's going to choose that which makes the most sense in that context. That seems to be here Rashi's, we'll call it, modus operandi. And this is going to be throughout his Pirush. Let's take a look at some of the basic tools or the basic ideas of when Rashi chooses to use Midrash. We're going to look at a number of specific tools. The first one is Rashi will use Midrash when Rashi wants to explain every detail. This is a critical issue, critically important methodology of Rashi, which will not be accepted by later Pashtanim. This is based on the following. Let's look at a Rashi and try to figure out what he's trying to do. Okay, so this Rashi is in a Chayei Sara. It describes Vayikacha Eved in source 16, Asara Gmalim Gmalei Adonav. He takes the servant takes 10 camels from the camels of his master. Vayelech v'kultuv Adonav biyodov Vayelech el Aram Naraim el Ir Nachon. Off he goes. Rashi says Migmalei Adonav from the camels of his servant master. And by the way, we all know this because we were all taught this. This is like sort of in our right. This is in our subconscious. That's how deep Rashi goes in our learning. Was this Nikarin Hayu Mishar Gmalim? These camels were recognizable among all the other camels. Why? Shoyu yotzim zemumim mipnei ha-gezel. They were muzzled not to avoid eating other fields. Shoyu b'solas acheros. And again, that's I'm quoting Barabbat's quoting the Midrash, right? So Rashi's quoting the Midrash. You say, why is Rashi doing that? That's really great, and it's very helpful. Because the children walk home and they all have the pictures that they're painting of the camels with the muzzles, right? But why is Rashi doing that here? The answer is profound. This is so profound. And that is, there's a debate which is had between Rabbi Akiva and Rabbi Yishmael. Rabbi Akiva and Rabbi Yishmael have the following debate. And it's a debate which had a halachic debate in the Gemara in Sanhedrin. Take a look at this in source 18. The Gemara says, Lecha Tetanya, the Braisa teaches us, he kores. The pasuk says a person who does such an action will be cut off. It says he kores ba'olam hazeh. I believe this is about avodah zarah, serving avodah zarah. A person will be cut off ba'olam hazeh. He kores la'olam habos. Divrei Rabbi Akiva. Rabbi Akiva says the reason why the pasuk says the word he kores twice is to show you that a person will be cut off from the life of Hashem in this world and in the world to come. That's how Rabbi Akiva understands it. Amar Rabbi Yishmael va'lo kvar ne'emar v'nichrusa. just if you read a few lines earlier, it says, and that person will be cut off. So if you're going to say that every time it says the word to kares, to be cut off, that it has to be taken specifically, then there's three times it says it in this context. So there's three worlds. Where's the third world? Right? So therefore it says, Ela, v'nechrosa b'olam hazeh, he kares l'olam haba, t'kares d'ibra Torah, k'loshim b'nei Adam. So Rabbi Shmuel says that really what the third repetition is not for specific meaning, is just the way that that people speak. Dibra Torah Kolashim B'nei Adam. The Torah speaks in a way, in the vernacular, that people can understand it. And therefore, there are details which are consequential and will have halachic import, and there are those which are really just like Hashav to Shivenu Loi, right? So maybe it's emphasis, right? Just make sure to take it back. Now the Gemara will darshan in many cases what the halachic import is. Rabbi Shmuel says that maybe there'll be ways that the Torah will speak, which is in our vernacular. Now we see this elsewhere. For instance, we looked at the Targum last week and the notion that the Targum always avoids what is called anthropomorphisms, right? So when the Torah says that HaKadosh Baruch Hu got angry, so we understand that doesn't mean to say Hashem got angry in a human way. So why does the Torah describe that? That's what's called Dibra Torah Kolashim B'nei Adam. The Torah speaks in a way, in the vernacular, we understand. So Rabbi Shmuel is extending that also to repetitions, right? So he's saying, in repetitions of words, it is possible that not every one of them is meaningful. That is a massive debate. Do you take that every word of the Torah has to have specific context and consequence, or do you say that there is also a linguistic angle to it which has to be understood by the reader, and that's why HaKadosh Baruch Hu wrote in such a way, right? Rashi is of the school of Rabbi Akiva. Rashi is of the school of Rabbi Akiva, that every word needs to be understood and has meaning. You will note, by the way, and I'm just pointing this to the note here, is as we get to Ibn Ezra and Radak, they do not hold. They fall more into the school of Rabbi Shmuel, just in terms of the tradition of Judaism. You'll find many times the Radak or the Ibn Ezra will move away from these very fancy explanations of what this means by saying, that's just Dibra Torah Kolashim B'nei Adam. This is just the Torah conveying an idea to you. Don't get too caught up in the details. That's what will happen. And later on, you will have people like the Malbim who will come right back to Rashi and say, no. There's a difference in the in synonymous words in the same pasuk, and here is what it means. You just don't know the rules of understanding the Mikra sufficiently to be able to know the differences, right? So the Radak and the Ibn Ezra are more generally open to what we'll call a more holistic perspective of vernacular, whereas the Malbim will be completely against that. Rashi lives in the school of Rabbi Akiva. So therefore, coming back to our pasuk, what is Rashi commenting on? What is bothering Rashi in this pasuk?
It's an extra phrase.
Good, the extra phrase. Now come back to our pasuk in Source 16. Vayikach ha'eved asara gmalim migmalei adonav. He took 10 camels of the camels of his master. It would be funny if he took 10 camels from the rhinos of his master, wouldn't it? Right? So the point is that the word gmalim is repeated. Migmalei adonav. Why is it repeated? Says Rashi, I will pull in the midrash to explain to you why the Torah identifies the camels of his master. Why are the camels of his master unique? Because they're mazels. That is what Rashi is doing. You understand? Rashi is addressing the extra text. Why? Because the school of thought of Rabbi Akiva, which is that every word, every phrase, every turn of phrase matters and is consequential. Let's go a little further as well into the next stage. Next idea is missing logic. So let's say there's something which is missing from the pasuk. So another example. Yosef is out. He's sent by his father. He's trying to find his brothers. He can't find his brothers in Shechem. So he goes over and we hear Vayimsoehu Ish in source 19. And the man says, what are you looking for? Okay, good. And so Rashi says, very famously, Ze Gabriel. This is referring to the Malach Gabriel. Shenemar v'ha'ish Gabriel. The word Gabriel is referred to as ha'ish. Notice, by the way, that the Ibn Ezra and the Ramban are happy to say, this is any person, this is the gas station attendant, right? They're not tied down by saying Gabriel, but every child comes over from school having learned Rashi and knows this is the Malach Gabriel. Why did Rashi choose that midrash in this particular case? Why did Rashi make this association? He did not invent this. Rashi is quoting the midrash. So why did he arrive at this idea over here? So you look at the pasukim, Rashi is addressing missing logic, right? So this man finds him. It's not that he found this man. This man finds him. And the man says, what are you looking for? And he says, I'm the assumption that that Yosef has when responding to him is Vaymes es achay anochim amavakesh hagida noli efaymarim. Tell me where they are. So it means to say the assumption of Yosef is that this fellow knows where they are. This man knows that he's looking for something, and he knows that this man knows the answer. How does that happen? Why should he know this man knows the answer? And why should this man know? Right? Why does he talk in such a way as if the answer is because this is not a regular human being? I mean, there's a gap in logic over here as to how the conversation, we take it for granted. Rashi's saying, yes, the conversation is not a normal conversation. Why? Because this is Malak Avriel. In other words, the subtext being filled in over here is explaining the conversation, the dialogue. Let's see another example. Another example of this. Oh, good, yeah. So this is a very famous one. In the second parak in Sefer Shmos, we're told, Vayiba Yimim HaRabim Ahim, Vayimos Menach Mitzrayim, Vayinchu Yisrael Bene Yisrael Ben Avodah. So the king dies, the nation of Israel calls out, Rashi says, I'm quoting the Midrash Shmos Rabbah, Nitzarea, this new king had leprosy, terrible, horrific description. He would slaughter children of Israel and bathe in their blood, whether it's literal, not literal. That's what's being described. And you say, well, what, is that shat? Is that what's really going on? Is that really what's happening? Why is Rashi bringing this in now? So the answer over here is, what's the missing logic in this pasuk? Why are they calling out now? Right? It says the king dies, they call out, and they're calling out, and Hashem hears their pain. Right? So their pain is now intensified; it's more acute now. Why? What's the logic in the middle? Like, what's the missing? What do we understand in the middle? Now, Adam Farshim will insert other logics, right? In here. But Rashi is saying this medrash fills in the subtext of understanding the continuation of the pasuk. Because without this, why is their pain intensified at this point in time? It must be the cruelty has been amplified. This medrash is expanding, is supplying the tradition or the supposition, right? We have to figure out what the medrash is doing over here as to why that pain is amplified in this particular place. That explains it in the pasuk. So again, this is Med Agada Hamyasheves Divrei Mikra. Now I can read the pasuk with the subtext of the logic flowing as well. Another example is missing events. Let's say there's a missing event in the Torah, and Rashi usually does this to explain chronological sequence. Right? So as an example, in Bereishis Lamed Zayin, where we describe Reuven has this whole thing with the pit, right? Reuven goes and tries to save Yosef, and then they go and sell Yosef, and then it describes, it says, Vayoshav Reuven El Abor, Vina in Yosef Abor, Vayikra Esbegadov. He goes to the pit, sees Yosef's not there, and he rips his clothes. So Rashi says, he went to serve his father. That was his turn in the rotation. He was mourning on the fact that he interrupted his father's private life. So this is Rashi according to Midrashim. Why is Rashi inserting this here? This is a very obvious one. What's missing? Where was he? Where was Reuven? Meaning, Reuven was there a second ago in the Pesukim. And he was actually speaking to them, let's not kill him, right? You don't alter your boy, right? That was, he said ago, a moment ago, but he's not there. So why is he not there? There's a gap in sequence here. This is not a gap in logic, but there's a gap in chronology. What event is missing here? Rashi is taking the measure to supply the missing event to explain why Reuven is absent and now returns. Right? This should be obvious. But that Rashi is now pulling this medrash in order to explain the story. There's missing pieces. A much more simple example is in the beginning of the 22nd parak of the Bereishis. After these matters, Hashem turned to Avram Avinu and said, calls out to him. What's about to happen? The Akedah, right? So Rashi says, he quotes the Gemara in Sanhedrin, Yeshmer Rosh Hashanah, Achar Dvarav Shel Satan, he quotes the Satan, right? The Satan who has this conversation about being Mekatreg Avram Avinu, and there's Achar Dvarav Shel Yishmael, he quotes, Shem Ispire Al Yitzhak, Shemal Begir Gimel Shana, he said that Yishmael was glorifying himself at Yitzhak because his bris is 13 as opposed to 8 days. So this is the Achar Dvarav. Rashi is now clearly addressing the fact that the Torah says this Akedah happens after these matters. What are these matters? And so he supplies Midrash, by the way. Now, the Rashbam, his grandson, will take this to the next stage without putting in Midrash. So as an example, Rashbam will say, what is the Achara Dvarim Ha'ela? Not calling in Midrash. What does the Rashbam says? What is the immediate preceding paragraph in the Torah? We read this on Rosh Hashanah, and we read this every Vayera, and that is? the alliance made between Avraham Avinu and Avimelech in the Gaza area, says the Lini Ulinini Unerdi, an intergenerational alliance, says the Rashbam, wait a second, you think you can guarantee the safety of your children and your grandchildren by making an alliance with these heathens? How do you know you even have the safety of your son? That, you know, the Akedah is a punishment for the alliance trying to gain security for his son. The Rashbam is addressing the same question, but he's not marshalling the Medrash over here to fill the gap. He's now marshalling the Pshat flow, right? Do you understand? He's doing the same thing without the Medrash there, and that's a very serious thing. And if you read the Rashbam, it's an extensive essay at the beginning over here. But again, that's the gap that Rashi is addressing. Similarly, moving over here, missing identities is a very famous thing Rashi will often do based on Chazal, and that is we don't know who the person is, Rashi will identify it with somebody who we already know. This is what's called in academic literature closed canon, right? Closed canon means to say, canon not referring to something which shoots big balls, but canon with one less N refers to canon as the corpus of material. So academically speaking, this means to say is that we need to understand the cast of characters within the cast of characters. So for instance, very famously, in the beginning of Shmos, Moshe Rabbeinu is going out to the building site on day two, Vayhi bayomer hasheni, v'hinei shnei anashim ivrim nitzim, these two Hebrews are fighting, vayomer l'rasho lama takeh re'echa, and he says to the evil one, why are you lifting your finger, by the way, your hand against your friend? Any school child who tries to hit their friend, every one of them knows this Rashi, right? Because they know is that if you lift your hand, you're a Rasha, right? That's what school children, that's the power of impact of Rashi. Says Rashi, Dasan Vaviron. We know that later on they identified as the people leave over the man, and we see that later on by Korach. So Rashi identifies these two characters, these two evil people, as the perennial evil characters who appear over here as well. We take that for granted. The Torah does not identify them. It was called a closed canon identification. Chazal tell us who are these people. We don't know. We really do know them later on as well. Similarly, as we passed just recently, who is this Isha Kushis? Rashi says, of course, based on Chazal, this is Tzipora. Why is she called Isha Kushis? Because of her beauty. Right? So these are what's called closed canon identifications. We don't know who the person is. Rashi is taking a measure to help identify not the missing logic, not the missing event, but the missing cast of character. Mr. Who is this person of Yah? And Rashi will do this many, many times. And our reading of Tanakh is influenced by Chazal because of Rashi's understanding of all of this. We take it for granted sometimes so much that we'll look in the Pesukim and we'll say, wait a second, it doesn't actually say that. Yes, because that's the tradition that Rashi has educated us with as well. Now, let's take a step backwards over here for a moment. And it's important to see this in the milieu of the times as well. And Rashi is living at a time which begins with a very prosperous time for the Jews. They do have certain rights in northern France, and the academies of Torah are going to flourish for the centuries to come. But at the same time, Rashi also lives through the First Crusade, the first of three Crusades. And it is a complicated, very difficult time that Rashi is living through. And it's important to also realize that as well. Now, there's a large academic debate, and I apologize for bringing in so much academia, but it is important to just appreciate this from this perspective. There's a debate. At this time as well, Christian Europe is also going through a reformation in terms of, not the later reformation, but in terms of a renaissance, is the better word, in terms of returning to their what we call basic exegesis, which means the understanding of the text, that's with a G, not a J, understanding the text on its own terms. And so Christian scholars at this point in time are also opening up the Bible and trying to understand it on its own terms. And this is what's happening now and will be continuing to happen in Judaism as well. Whether the start of the Christians and the Jews followed or vice versa is inconsequential because this part of the Torah is waiting to be explored. But there is a lot of focus on Bible study at this point in time. And a lot of this actually leads to public debate against the Jews. Well, the Jews are not interested in engaging with the Christians, but the Christians are oftentimes looking into the text and trying to use the text as a way of understanding their theology and therefore turning it back upon the Jews to disprove the Jews, right? That's a lot of what's happening over here. And this will continue for the next few centuries, whether in Spain, whether in Northern Europe as well. These are going to lead to great debates in Paris later on, great debates in Aragon later on. These are complicated things. There's going to be a lot of very complicated times to come for the Jews, and we're going to learn a little bit about that in the Kinos on Tisha B'Av. But be it as it may, it's important to understand Rashi within this gap as well. Not that Rashi's commentary is a polemic, but there are references that are helpful to understanding what's going on as well. As an example, this is a very important Gemara, which is in Brachos. A very, very critical Gemara, which helps explain the trends of Jewish education and curriculum for the centuries following. The Gemara in Brachos tells us that when they came to Rabbi Eliezer HaGadol, Rabbi Eliezer is Rabbi Eliezer ben Hyrcanus, right? And he was the one who wrote the earliest Midrash we have extant, which is called Pirkei Rabbi Eliezer. Rabbi Eliezer ben Hyrcanus, Rabbi Eliezer HaGadol wrote a Midrash called Pirkei Rabbi Eliezer. It's the first Midrash we really have. Says when he was on his deathbed, teach us the way to the way to the world to come. Now, by the way, just for those who are interested in unpacking this properly, there's another version of his deathbed conversation, and that's found towards the later parts of Sanhedrin. And the reason why it's such a consequential discussion is because he dies in Cherem, right? He dies in Cherem because of the debate of about the Tanur Shel Achnai. So he dies in Cherem, and Rabbi Akiva, when he comes to visit him, Rabbi Akiva being his prime Talmud, sees the consequence of not having been able to learn properly from his teacher. That's a separate conversation also had on the deathbed. This is it seems to be more out of that context, but there is a reference to it. He says, Amar lohem, hizaru b'chvod chavreichem, be careful of the honor of your friends, umanu b'neichem mihigayom. Refrain from studying Higayon. How's Higayon translated today's vernacular?
Logic,
right? Don't learn logic. That's what it seems to me. And without going to the other stage suggestions he makes. What does that mean? Well, to understand that you need Rashi, of course. Says Rashi, Loi targilum b'mikra yoser midai mishum demashcha. Loshon acher mishichas yiladim. Don't learn them too much mikra. Mikra refers to Tanakh in the Gemara. Don't learn too much Mikra because Demashcha, what's Mashcha? It pulls them in. So it seems that Rashi is saying is don't learn too much Tanakh because it pulls you in. Meaning it's in terms of it's not that it's bad, but that it's going to be, it's the wrong emphasis as well. And this is going to be, in fact, adopted by Rashi's grandson, Rabbeinu Tam. Rabbeinu Tam, when the Gemara says in Kiddushin that a person should yishalesh sha'osav, a person should divide their time into three, where they do a third Mikra, a third Mishnah, a third Talmud, Rabbeinu Tam in his commentary on the Tosfos, really two generations after Rashi will say, well, us, we no longer need to do Mikra and Mishnah because it's all included in Gemara itself, right? So Ashkenazic tradition is moving away from Mikra. Rashi is already indicating this is happening already now, and which is fascinating because Rashi wrote on all of Mikra, right? And there's a debate that goes even further. Some of the interpretations of this Rashi is not just that it's Mashcha, but that it's actually bad because there are those who will interpret the Mikra incorrectly. They will interpret it incorrectly and therefore use it against you, right? Which is a reference to the Christian ideas that are happening around them, something which is not happening in Spanish Jury, right? In Spanish Jewry, the way this Gemara is understood is this Higayon refers to philosophy, not Mikra. In Europe, European Jewry, we're seeing a movement away from Mikra, and with a few notable exceptions, the focus of the academies created after Rashi are going to be primarily on Gemara. With a few exceptions, there's Rabbi Yosef Bechor Shoru's Tosfos, one of the Baalei HaTosfos. There are, the Rashbam himself is going to also comment. There are going to be commentaries, but in general, the focus is going to be more Talmudic here on inwards, and part of that is moving away from the Christian debates of the time. The focus is going to be more here, or as Rashi's basic interpretation is, Demashcha is a focus of curriculum. Right, meaning to say, don't spend too much time on Tanakh if you can get it all from the Gemara as well. This is part of the milieu of this. Let's move onwards to see a few examples where Rashi sort of helps us understand a little bit of the complexities of Tanakh. Here's an example, and we've all learned this, but it's so important to appreciate this. Beginning of Bereshis, day 6, HaKadosh Baruch Hu says that it creates a human being. But it seems to be that it's not just a simple process. HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, Naaseh Adam, let us make human beings. Rashi explains, what does it mean, Naaseh? Who is God talking to? Rashi explains that he's talking to Pamaliel Shemala, which means the celestial host. HaKadosh Baruch Hu is talking to the angels in heaven. Why is that? Rashi tells us a very important lesson to be learned. And that is the lesson is that you need that higher ups need to consult their lower those who are lower than them, which is remarkable because HaKadosh Baruch Hu created the angels, but he's consulting the angels when creating humanity because humanity is going to be of great consequence to creation as well. Rashi then goes on to say in source 36, second paragraph, Af al pi shalai siyahu b'yitzirasov yesh makom leminos liridois. Even though there was no one who was helping HaKadosh Baruch Hu create humanity, and there are places for the minim in Rashi's language means Heretics, that's the Gemara language is heretics, but Rashi, when he applies it, refers to the Christians. Even the Christians will question, so the Rashi says, the lesson of the humility of leadership is more important than the misinterpretation of the minim. Now, why is that consequential? Because what would the minim, what do the Christians say on this pasuk? Naase Adam means to say, God has a few other partners, there's a trinity, right? That's what they learn from this pasuk. Rashi now addresses it, moves away from it, and says the lesson is more important than the misinterpretation. Right, very carefully over here, moving away from the Christian interpretation of the pasuk and addressing it. He's not ignoring it, but he's saying that there's a lesson which is much more important than the misinterpretation as well. Listen to this. These are basic things we learn. We learn this Rashi, but notice the difference, the way he changes the midrash ever so slightly. Okay, Rashi, the Torah says, Shema Yisrael Hashem Elokeinu Hashem Echad. Listen to Israel, it says three times a day. The Sifrei, there's the midrash halacha on Devarim over there, says, Hashem Elokeinu Aleinu, Hashem Echad, Al Kol HaBoi Olam. So Hashem is a God to us and a God to the whole world. Hashem Elokeinu Bo'olam Hazeh, Echa Hashem Echad Bo'olam Haba. So Hashem is to us and the rest of the world, to this world and this world and the next world. Rashi, in quoting the Midrash, is ever so slightly different in Source 39. Hashem Elokeinu Hashem Echad, Hashem Shu Elokeinu Ata, V'loy Elokei Almos, Hu Asid Liyos Hashem Echad. Hashem is to us a God and not to the rest of the world. They don't get Him. They don't understand Him. Is in the future going to be the God for everybody, which means, as opposed to the Midrash, which is saying, is that there is Hashem for us and the nations in this world and the next, meaning say that's universal across time and across space. Rashi is saying, is that right now, the only people who really understand HaKadosh Baruch Hu are us. And in the future, there's going to be a time where the Ummah Sa'olam, where the nations will also have to come around to the principle of God being there. Rashi is clearly saying is that the time that we're living, it is very clear that the nations of the world do not get it. There's something missing over there. And we are the only holders, the bearers of that torch, while they are misinterpreting and parading through Europe, killing Jews on the way to Israel. Just understanding the complexities of Rashi's living through as well. Similarly, when it comes to chosenness of the nation of Israel, the pasuk says, "Leman hakim oscha yom loy la'am v'u yelo l'chol l'chol l'elokim." HaKadosh Baruch Hu says He's going to make you His nation, and you will be His God. Rashi says, "V'u yelo l'chol l'elokim lefi shidiber l'chol v'nishpa l'avosecha shelo l'hachlif ezarim v'uma acheres." Hashem made a promise that He's not going to switch His future generations with any other nation. L'kachu oiser l'chem b'shvuas alalu sheloi taknitu. So that's why you cannot take a shvuas shav. That's why you can't take His name in vain, because He is not taking you in vain. He decided and made a promise, and He's never going to break that. So don't break your promises when you use His name. Right? Clearly, what was the philosophy or the theology of Christianity is? Jews were left behind. They were left in the gutter. They weren't as religious. It wasn't so important. Hashem says, understand. He took His promise to you very seriously. And understand, therefore, you take His name very seriously when using it as well. And similarly, Rashi will use these ideas, like in Shir HaShirim, he'll talk about the idea of knowing His words and expressing His words in order to be able to respond to those who are critiquing you. So Rashi is not just teaching us lessons as well, he's also silently, very subtly as well, putting in pieces that relate to us and the complexity of being a Jew in a diaspora reality as well. There is a debate, and I want to close with this because I know we're short on time over here. There is a debate which Dr. Rock points out that is had between Dr. Leibowitz and other interpreters of Rashi. Dr. Nachama Leibowitz points out in Source 33 that it's a quotation from this essay that Dr. Leibowitz wrote with Moshe Arendt, who says, Rashi enlists the Midrashim only when they respond to a question which arises from the text or the verse, when they resolve a difficulty, solve a problem, fill a gap, like we just learned, i.e. when they help render to understand the text written. He does not cite Midrashim in order to decorate the words of the Torah with pearls of rabbinic wisdom, nor does he bring them for a mere sermon, a moral lesson, or anything of that sort. So Dr. Leibowitz is very clear. If you want to understand Rashi, understand what Rashi is trying to explain, what gap there is that he's filling, and you can answer every Rashi has to answer the following question. What is bothering Rashi? And if you don't know what that is, then you haven't read David deep enough. That's what Dr. Leibowitz would suggest. There's no other homiletical ideas that are behind there. However, there are those who disagree. As an example, so for instance, in this essay written by Dr. Grossman, this is the basic assumption of Rashi, that in 34, is that since the aim of the Torah is to educate one to believe in God and keep his commandments, the commentator must embrace this purpose and not suffice the commentary alone. In many cases, one may accomplish this purpose, to educate towards faith and to strengthen weak knees, by using midrashim, which dovetail with the language of the verses, thus accomplishing two aims, to explain and to educate simultaneously. However, in cases in which the homily seems crucial from an educational point of view, one must cite it despite the fact that the connection between it and the language of the verse is very shaky. The famous question, which was so beloved by Nechama, what is bothering Rashi, is appropriate for many of his comments, but not all of them. So it's possible to say that Rashi might be doing something not to respond to a gap in logic or sequence, but for an educational value of telling you what the Ratzon Hashem is, or a value. And by the way, this is so true in so many ways if you think about it. Like, how many children come back from school and they know what is the difference between vengeance and lo tikom v'lo titar? What's the difference between vengeance and what's the other word?
Enmity
and all. We all know. Well, the person who borrows the axe and that does not lend the axe and doesn't lend the axe, the person doesn't lend the shovel the next day, that's Rashi, right? Rashi quotes the Midrashim. So many of the lessons of Rashi might be educational, not necessarily just explaining the verse. You might argue that even that as well. That might be Pshat as well. But the educational value that Rashi is giving us, and it cannot be overstated how much of our educational perspective of our children and ourselves is as a function of Rashi's explanation of the values of the Torah. Perhaps some of us have learned more about Judaism through Rashi than any other teacher that we've ever had in terms of the values of what the Torah is, what Rechilos is, what Lifnei Iver is. All these ideas come directly from the Rashi that we've been drilled from the time we started. I want to close with the following observation, and I know time is late already. And that is, the Gemara tells us that there's a halacha, and it's brought in Shulchan Aruch, that a person needs to do Shnai Mikra ve'echad Targum, that a person needs to read over the Torah twice every week and read it with a Targum. What is allowed to be in the Targum? Right, Tosfos says in Source 47, Shnai Mikra ve'echad Targum, Yesh Meforim Vuhu Adin Lelo'azos Balaz. The Tosfos says, some people say you can read it in French, right? Tosfos is an academy in northern France. He says, Shalohem, havi kamoi targum shmefarish lefamim, ki kamoi shah targum mefarish lamaoretz kach haim vinim toich alaz. Veloi nahira, shera targum mefarish vamasha ein lil moid mina ivri kida ashkachon bakama duchti. So the Tosfos says that is incorrect. You should not use another language as your Targum of the Torah, because as we saw, Targum has in it certain details of tradition and explanation of the Lashon HaIvri, of the Hebrew language, which no one else has. Therefore, you should stick to Targum. However, as the Rambam paskens, later on we see the Sefer Mitzvos Gedolos later on say in Source 49, in the underlined section, Vani danti lifnei rabosai. Sha'pirush moyil yoser mina targum v'hoideli rabbeisai, and he says that in fact it is possible that when learning the pirush, which he refers to as Rashi, that Rashi in fact is more important over here than even in Targum, and that's how it's paskin in Shulchan Aruch. The Shulchan Aruch says that the optimal way to learn Chumash Shnai Mikra ve'echad Targum is alongside with Rashi. That's the optimal way of doing it, because it helps us understand really the context of the Mikra. To understand what that means to say is that Rashi has now been put on the pedestal of Targum, the Targum itself. That's how much Rashi has imported and given us the access to Chazal's understanding al pi pshat of what's going on over here, and that's why it's so consequential. Even if you look at the beginning of the introduction of the Art Scrolls translation into English of Shir HaShirim, they tell you explicitly, we are not translating this into English, we're translating this into Rashi. Right? All of the English explanation of Art Scroll's Stern Edition of Shir HaShirim is Rashi's explanation. We're holding the traditions of Chazal as best as possible within the English language. It's hard to overstate the impact of Rashi upon our lives and the impact of Klal Yisrael's life. This now opens up the gates for an entire new perspective on Torah, which will lead us next week, Be'ezra Hashem, to the Pashtunim and their proliferation over the coming generations, to understand what Rashi has enabled us to do. Thank you so much for your time. Yeah, sure.